behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
Hey, everybody. I'm Ben Boland.
Oh, that's a little bit of a switch up.
Yeah, this episode, in fact, is a little bit of a switch up for us, or a return to form, if you will.
Yeah, is it a switch up? Because this would be our ninth edition of this type of show, right? This format.
Yeah. This is nuts and bolts. Ladies and gentlemen, listeners who have not heard one of these episodes before, prepare yourself for a short attention span theater of all things automotive.
And just about everything that we cover, there's either some left-off information from podcasts,
yeah.
there's a little bit of listener mail thrown in here.
There's a new development after we publish or something.
Yeah, exactly. There's some corrections that we'll make, I guess, along the way. There's I got a couple little surprises I'm going to throw in here and there. I've got about four of these things that I want to mention.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a kind of a catch-all show. And
uh-huh.
If you haven't heard one of these episodes before and you want to kind of get an idea of what they feel like before jumping right into this one, because not that there's that prerequisite or anything, but go to our RSS feed and search for Nuts and Bolts, and you'll find episodes 1 through 8 there waiting
yes.
for you.
So, and they're all chock full of the same sort of stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
So without further ado, let's get into – we should also mention that some of the things that we're going to talk about are things that we think are fascinating or interesting, but – not enough to fill an entire podcast.
Yeah, there's a couple of those thrown in there as
yeah.
well. And I've got just kind of a long list of listener requests that I'm going to sprinkle in here.
Mm-hmm.
This is how I want to start the show.
Okay.
A correction, my own stupidity, Ben.
Oh, well,
how about
okay.
I'm taking it upon myself to say that I made a mistake that I shouldn't have made, but I did. And it was recent, too.
Well, that's a very smart thing to do. That's not stupid at all.
You know, when we were talking about pace cars?
Yes.
And we got to the 2013 edition of the Daytona 500 pace
mm-hmm.
car.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, it goes from 2006 with Jay Leno all the way through 2013 with Mark Roos or Reese or whoever
mm-hmm.
that was, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't know who that is. That's a celebrity of some kind, right?
Okay.
It's a celebrity driver. That is, and this isn't quite as bad as it may sound initially, but that is the current president of General Motors North America, Ben. And that company goes through changes like you wouldn't believe fast recently, right?
Because mm-hmm.
It's not the era when management pretty much stayed in place for, you know, a decade
Decades,
at a time.
Yeah,
exactly. So it's not quite as bad as it sounds. And that's the president of GM. However, president falls about number 4 on the list of who's who at GM, I guess, because there's the CEO and chairman of the board.
Mm-hmm.
There's the CFO, the GM vice chairman, and then the GM North American president, who is Mark. And, I just didn't keep up with who's the fourth in line there at GM. So my mistake. I thought it was maybe an actor of some kind, but it turns out it's the president of General Motors.
Well,
a name that you would think that we would know.
Yeah.
But then again, fourth in the chain of command, and you know all the changes. Yeah, it was an easy mistake to make at the time, I guess.
Well, I personally, Scott, I'm just so behind on celebrities. I'm always out of the loop when my friends are talking about films or actors. I don't really know.
Me
so.
Too. We've talked about that in the past when we try to identify actors in certain movies that we recommend.
Yeah.
And we have no idea.
So do you feel a little better with it off your chest?
I feel like I've gotten that off my chest. I feel better about it now.
Okay. And it speaks volumes to your character, my friend.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. I would like to start after your correction here. I want to do something that we've never really had the chance to do, and that is to talk about flops, bad cars, lemons.
Oh, okay.
Because now, you and I have talked about this before, and we always agreed that it's a little bit too negative to be the subject of an entire episode.
Yeah, we focused on maybe some flops, right? Or some
right.
that, you know, they make lists, and you know, who makes the list? That's the other thing, is
mm-hmm.
who's calling this car a flop? Other people will call it a collectible.
Yes, and there's some great writing here, but what I have is a article with the greatest automotive flops of the last 25 years.
Mm.
And they say that a flop, I appreciated this. This is why I chose this one. A flop is not necessarily a bad car. Bad cars can come and go all the time. But flops are something more, and it's kind of a perfect storm of bad luck, bad planning, and perhaps engineering.
Now, you said 25 years. That's, boy, that's relatively recent. And
right.
Because a lot of the lists that you'll see will go back to, you know, the Edsel, and they'll go back to
sure.
the Pacer
yeah.
and vehicles like that. So what have you got?
Well, what do you think about the Vector, Scott?
The Vector? That didn't make the list, did it?
Yeah, the Vector.
What a cool-looking car that is, yeah?
Yeah, the Vector made the list, and Jeremy Clarkson called it very probably the worst car in the entire world.
Oh, man, okay. There's sort of a cool angle to this thing. I mean, it's a neat looking car. It's kind of fun to see one rolled out. Maybe
it looks really cool.
Maybe at a Concours event or something mm-hmm. like that, where you know this prototype comes out. But man, I don't know.
Well, the first Vector, the concept was the W2, and then the first one they sold was the W8, and only 22 cars were built.
yeah, they didn't sell too well.
Clarkson is and Vector is still around. Clarkson was referring, to the Lamborghini powered M12.
Okay.
Here's another one: the Sterling.
The Sterling, okay. I'll buy that.
The first sentence says, "Leave it to the Brits to flopify anything even remotely identifiable as a Honda product," which is rough. Chrysler's TC by Maserati.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Now, I had a former boss who spent a lot of time and money restoring a TC to original condition.
Restoring.
Which, yes.
Okay.
And, I mean, he took it to a place where, you know, the guy would work on it at night in his garage and,
yeah.
you know, every little nut and bolt was polished back to its original polish or
wow.
original condition and
mm-hmm.
A lot of money and time in it. And he loved the car, but I wouldn't have spent a lot of time doing that Maserati. I would have spent it on more like on a Bora or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And there's a quotation here, which we're going to censor because it's not entirely appropriate for all our audience members. It's a bumper sticker seen on a Chrysler TC by Maserati in Berkeley, California. And it says, "My other Maserati is also a piece of and so the next one there would be the Subaru SVX. What do you think?
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
This list, I've got a real problem with this list. This, the SVX, that's kind of a cool car. I saw one about a year and a half ago, I think, here in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
That was the one with the little half windows, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But the, unfortunately, a lot of people thought the styling was awkward.
Okay, you know what? You're right. All of these are cars that just didn't sell too well. Didn't really.
That's the flop. It's
yeah.
not necessarily that they're bad cars from an engineering
okay.
perspective, although that could happen, like with the Maserati car.
Now I'm a little slow, Ben.
No, you're a quick person. You're nimble. And so also, let's keep in mind that the SVX was like $25,000 in '92.
Yeah, kind of expensive for the day.
If you're going to spend that much money, you want to have the perfect car. Jaguar X-Type, they say that this...
the X-Type. Okay, the all-wheel drive, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I buy that, yeah. Don't see a lot of those around.
Right. Chrysler Crossfire?
Yeah, I could see that, too. Didn't really go anywhere with it. That was a cool design, though.
Yeah. Our buddy Matt, who's a co-host of Stuff That I Want You to Know, drives a Crossfire.
You know, the guy with the Maserati that I was telling you about?
Yeah.
My former boss?
Uh-huh.
He had a Crossfire also.
Oh,
when they
wow.
were brand new.
Oh, man. So in the second year of Crossfire production, Chrysler resorted to dumping excess inventory on Overstock.com.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I'll just go through the next ones quickly. Dodge Durango Hybrid or the Chrysler Aspen Hybrid.
Yeah, okay. Those are too big to be hybrids.
Lincoln Blackwood.
Yep. Too expensive for what it was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Your refined taste. Here's a Lincoln
yeah.
F-150, basically.
Yeah, and it had pinstriping, right? It had
yeah.
like a crazy pinstripe design. Not just one pinstripe. I mean, it had pinstriping like a suit.
Uh-huh.
Like multiple pinstripes on the back end. It was just kind of it was very expensive.
Well, it reminds me of brand dilution ideas,
yeah.
and it also reminds me of the there's a question here. Should a luxury car maker like Lincoln make a pickup truck?
True.
That's supposed to get dirty and haul stuff.
Mm-hmm.
GMC Envoy XUV.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chevrolet.
Oh, that's the one that the top opened up on, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I think I remember that. Yeah, I was working as a contractor for GM at that time, and we did training videos on that, how to fix that thing, and that was crazy.
Pickup/SUV.
Yeah, it had like a back end that would completely open up, but there was a trick to it. I mean, you have
mm-hmm.
to look that one up to see the operation to really get it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was trouble for service guys.
And then there's the Chevrolet SSR.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I pass it to you.
All right. So let's do some listener email rapid fire here.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I won't go through too many of these right now. We'll get back to it maybe.
Yeah.
Gary from Facebook says that he saw a KTM crossbow that was at Road America recently and said that after listening to the podcast, he realized that he shouldn't be calling it Expo. So he felt like he was in the know, I guess, because of our podcast. So how's that?
Yeah, thank you. And just to react to that, I'm on Team Gary. You can't be blamed for it, Gary. Don't beat yourself up.
Yeah.
It looks like you should say Expo.
It does look like Expo instead of crossbow.
Yeah.
But glad we could help you out, Gary.
So yeah, thanks for listening.
Made you look like a good guy at the track, right?
Yeah.
All right, so here's one from Adrian. And let's see, Adrian suggests kit cars. And we have a lot of kit car fans.
That's cool.
Adrian has a replica of a 1955 Porsche Speedster in his home state of California that's registered as a special construction vehicle. However, they're changing around the rules so that you're not able to register the car based on the donor vehicle. So instead of, you know, it being a special construction vehicle, and it's no longer a 1966 VW Beetle. They've got this new insurance issue that's going on that may, you know, kind of throw a twist into this whole thing. So,
yeah.
We'll have to dig into that, but we've got a few suggestions here for kit cars. So
mm-hmm.
I think, that's one that we're going to follow up on for sure.
Yeah.
And we have a listener named Luke that has mentioned kit cars a few times. And I think Luke is the one with the car that looks like the Lotus 7.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
I'm not sure what brand of that one
uh-huh.
is, but I'll have to look that up again. We've got a message here from Rudy Smith. Now, Rudy is the guy that told me about the Microcar Museum closing.
Oh, yeah.
Famously or infamously, saved my butt on seeing that.
Rudy's the man. We owe you because that was really cool.
On the last weekend. Now, he also was the suggester, I guess, of the Ed Roth podcast, and he wanted to thank us for doing that because he said he did a great job with that and that he listened to that over his recent, most current road trip, which is about 80 hours of driving, Ben.
Wow.
That's a long road trip.
Wow.
80 hours of driving. So that's a good one. And he had another suggestion, Rudy did.
Hmm.
Something about a coal dust powered GM factory built 78 Cadillac.
Oh yeah, yeah. I remember reading this email.
These are Cadillacs that are powered by coal dust. And I'm going to have to look into that. But I guess there were some other coal dust burning cars that were used during World War II in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
That you know they got this great big hopper apparatus that I think he mentioned where a rumble seat would be in those early cars.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So we'll look into that, too, Rudy, because that's interesting.
I've got some Tesla news.
Okay, what have you got?
I have a couple of pieces of Tesla news for you, buddy. Now, you heard what I also heard, right?
I think
so. And that is that the electric car company Tesla has paid off its federal loan, that's $465 million. They've paid it off completely and almost a decade early.
That is pretty awesome. That's really good. And isn't that the first company that's received a loan in this type of loan, the first company to have paid off the loan in full?
I believe so.
So that's really great. I mean, that's good for them.
Now, that's because the Model S is just to – be completely honest, the Model S is a hell of a car.
Yeah, it's kicking ass right now. It's selling a lot of cars, and
mm-hmm.
We've talked about this before. You know, I'm not a hybrid fan. I'm not an electric fan. I do like the Tesla design. I really do. I like the Roadster, of course,
mm-hmm.
and there's some great things about that. I really like seeing the S model on the road. It's a beautiful car.
Yeah.
So I say good for Tesla. That's excellent. I hope they keep going this way.
Yeah, and you know that I am often skeptical about hybrids, but I love the idea of a viable electric car that, you know, that doesn't have some of the same problems. You know, I'm so cheap, man. I'm hesitant to buy mm-hmm. a new technology until I see that it has been proven, you know.
It's a good-looking car.
It is a good-looking car. I better start saving my pennies.
Was it Motor Trend Car of the Year, I think? Is that the one?
Yeah,
or was
Consumer.
Consumer Automotive gave it, 10 out of 10 or something like that?
Yeah, and we talked about that because they had some quotation on there in their review where they said, is this the best car ever? We don't know, but it's pretty close.
It's the best one they've ever tested, right?
Yeah.
Best car they've ever tested, which is amazing for, you know, Consumer Reports to say something like that. So, a couple more emails?
Yeah, a couple more emails.
Okay, so we've got one here from Richard, and Richard wrote in about the Bond car. This is Richard, the guy with the drove the 1936 Rolls. Remember the,
Yeah.
You remember that story about how?
The prom?
Yeah, the prom. And yeah. How he had a hard time keeping it on the road because he was on the right hand side driving and that whole mix up.
That's a good story.
That was funny. He saw the Bond car at the 2012, Los Angeles, California show, the car show.
The, DB8?
Yeah, that's the one I think with the machine guns below the headlights and the bullet holes in the windshield and all that stuff. You know, so the Ben Hur style wheel skites that come out; those are so cool.
Yeah.
But he sent us some good photos of that, so thank you, Richard, for that. I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Here's just a quick one, and this is actually just a mention I want to make. This guy is a mail carrier from West Virginia. His name is Eric Stone. And he says he's a mail carrier that listens to our podcast while he carries mail, always enjoys it, and he just saw a list of list that he thought we would like. It's called 11 of the Baddest Cars from Classic Movies, and that sounds right up our alley. So I did take a look at the list, and Ben, it's a good list, so we should maybe sometime revisit our movie car podcast because this one had some fantastic ideas in it. So thank you, Eric. I appreciate it, and I don't know. Stay dry out there carrying the mail. I don't know. What do you say? Stay cool.
Yeah,
it's summertime.
Careful. Yeah, and thank you for bringing the mail. I think that mail carriers don't get the credit they deserve.
Absolutely.
To be honest with you, and
so thank you, Eric.
And you know us too well, man. If you called the movie car thing, may I interject with the other piece of Tesla news?
Yes, why not?
Okay, so Tesla hasn't just paid off their loan early; they have also hired Aston Martin's vehicle engineering leader. So they hired chief engineer of vehicle engineering from Aston Martin, Chris Porritt, to be their new VP of engineering. So he's the guy who was chief engineer for Aston Martin's 177 supercar.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Yeah,
and he's been doing this for 25 years. I'm sorry, this being automotive engineering.
Sure.
And he joined Aston Martin in 97. That's where he brought the engineering stuff in-house. They also did some of the architecture for DB9s, the V12 Vantage. He was at Land Rover before that. And I think that is sort of a – not to read too much into it, Scott, but – that's kind of a statement of intent, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah. So they're making plans for the future there, that's for sure.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see Tesla in a Bond car role yet.
No, probably not.
I mean, they can't mess with the Aston Martins.
No, I think that's got to remain a tradition. So all right.
Yeah, what's
this? I've got one of these little facts here that I want to bring you throughout the podcast. Now, I've got four of these that I want to mention.
And this is number 1.
This is number 1 right here. I guess we'll just call it like little known car facts or something like that,
I guess.
Because there's a few things here and there that are kind of interesting that I've gathered up along the way. Now, we talked about Grand Prix cars, right? And we talked about Formula One cars. This goes back to the Grand Prix racers, specifically the Auto Union race cars that I mentioned that I love so much, the 1934 to 1938 Auto Union cars. If you need to take a look at the photo of those things, they're gorgeous. They're like a great big tube where the driver's at the front and huge supercharged V16 in the back. So these enormous engines, right? Now, they're extremely complicated machines, as you can imagine. But just how complicated, Ben? This is where this little fact comes in.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. That's my part.
I know that.
How complicated are they?
thank you. This is like a 70s game show. So complicated that the crank, now imagine this, the crankshaft alone, just the crankshaft, so the bottom end of the engine, normally a single piece, a single item, a monolithic design, over 1,000 parts alone in the crankshaft. And I know a lot of listeners are scratching their head right now thinking, there's no way. How could you construct a crankshaft? Now, this is a V16, an enormous, enormous engine, huge supercharged engine.
Mm-hmm.
But the crankshaft alone, which, again, in most modern cars, is a single-piece design. It's either forged, it's either cast, or maybe even sometimes machined from, like, a big billet piece of steel or whatever it is. some, you know, some can be assembled from a couple pieces, but not 1,000 pieces, Ben. This is over 1,000 pieces in just the crankshaft. So I thought that was something that was worth mentioning, because I don't think a lot of listeners probably know that. I had no idea, and I'm a fan of that type of car.
Yeah, I did not know that at all.
That's extremely complicated.
That is little known. I'd love to see some schematics.
I have seen something similar to that, nothing detailed, of course. I mean, okay, there's nothing that really lays it all out, because I don't think there's any kind of owner's manual for, or I mean, shop manual for this type of mm-hmm. vehicle. It's more like, you know, here's a shot of it, and you can't quite get an idea of exactly where all the 1,000 pieces lay in that design.
Right. There's no 1,000 crankshaft pieces for dummies.
No, no, nothing like that. But still, I thought that was a cool fact.
And I've got some cool things here. Some of our Facebook fans wrote in with us. Bruce wrote in to say, on the subject of loophole vehicles, I can name a couple that the great state of Alabama allows. Hmm. And these are some things with law, okay? So, one, says Bruce, the earliest you can legally drive a car alone is 16, but you can get a motorcycle license at 15 as long as it's under 200 cc.
Ah, not bad.
That's relatively small for a motorcycle, but it is powerful enough to get in some serious mischief. And then number two, if both your parents are legally blind, you can get a full driver's license at 15. Which, if you think about it, makes sense, I think. Because
that makes
you
perfect
know, you're
sense.
Helping your parents.
Yeah, sure.
And that's that was, I think, a great thing to bring up. Want to thank Bruce for that. Also, I believe we already mentioned Aaron Cooper's earlier note about golf carts. As loophole vehicles.
Yeah, I think we did, yeah.
So
yeah.
The loophole vehicle stuff goes back to our Swedish A-Tractors episode, which was a lot of fun to do.
That was fun.
I've got something here from Glenn Beck. I don't know.
Wait. From yeah. Glenn Beck?
See, we were talking about this. Glenn, I hope you're listening, because we were trying to figure out if you were that Glenn Beck.
It's probably not that Glenn Beck, but it's the Glenn Beck, the car stuff listener.
Yeah, that's the Glenn Beck you are to us, buddy. And either way, we're thrilled that you're listening to the show. So Glenn writes to us and says, I haven't heard you discuss gimmick road rallies for charity. I'm sure there are several organizations that do this sort of thing. Here's some info on one I've become involved with. The group is Rally North America, and the rally format is a 3-day scavenger hunt on wheels by 80 teams of enthusiasts and their rides. Each day includes an off-road activity, a dozen scenic or historic checkpoints, a few hundred miles of some of North America's most scenic highways, and then they also have a lot of performance cars in there. There's a range of cars. He says, you know, they've got Mustangs, Corvettes, Vipers, but they also have Corvairs, Escorts, Prius, even a smart car. Mm-hmm. Speeding's discouraged. And so he's making a point here with the ultimate end game of the Rally New England. It is to raise $80,000 for a place called Camp Sunshine. And the mission of Camp Sunshine is to provide professional assistance and respite for a terminally ill child and their immediate family.
Oh, very good cause. Now, you said he wanted to raise $80,000 this year for this camp. Now, you'd think that's an awful lot of money for a charity road rally to raise. But the previous year, they raised $70,000 for the Accelerated Cure Project for Multiple Sclerosis. So
right.
This is a tried and true method for them to raise money for great causes, and it's not anything like a cannonball run, you know, under the law type thing. this is all on the level, and as they mentioned, you know, there's speeding's discouraged, and you know, it's mm-hmm. it's all on board, you know, it's all on top level, I guess.
Oh, he also wanted to give him a shout out, and let's go ahead and do this. Glenn, a big shout out to you in your 2006 Legend Lime Mustang GT and Go Team Limer. Thank you for writing us such an inspiring suggestion, and I really would love to cover charity rallies in the future.
Very cool. I hope some of our listeners look into that and maybe make a donation or even participate. So that would be that'd be a lot of fun.
What do you got?
Let's see. Boy, what don't I have? I've got a ton of stuff here. We've got something from Simon Burke, who's from, again, we've talked about Simon before. We've had, he's even made some suggestions here, but, A-Tractors. That was
yep,
his.
That was Simon.
From Oma, North Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm saying that right.
Again, Oma? As we said last time, thank you for telling us how to pronounce that.
Oma, North Ireland. He talks about the runaway diesel, and he's had firsthand experience with this. And the way that he handles it is he has stalled the engine. Let's see. When the runaway starts, you turn the key off so that the car is off, or, you know, it will be off.
Right.
Dip the clutch, select the highest gear you have, and instead of trying to accelerate like normal, you stand as hard as you can on the brake and then release the clutch. And that's the other way. So I had mentioned mm-hmm. you starve it for air.
Right.
And that works, but that's an extremely dangerous thing to do because you have to reach under the hood.
Like that YouTube video of the guy who has the engine just mounted.
Yeah.
Just an open air engine, not attached to anything. Yeah. And it starts to have the diesel runaway problem, and then he just stuffs that rag in it.
He's quick enough to think to put a – I think he could put a piece of wood over it or
that's
something.
That's right,
And eventually sucked that thing into it too because it was a lot of power. But anyways, he said the idea is to stall the engine, and you can do this from inside the cab, which is much better than actually reaching your arms and face under there.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you again, Simon. Appreciate that. John Heedley? Heedley, mm-hmm. I think it is, mentions that there's a correlation with Yenko, Corvair, and sleeper cars. Now, Ben, I think we may have talked about this one already in the past because we talked about the Corvair, of course. And
yes.
I think not long after that, we talked about John's email here. But there's something here that we didn't mention is that there's a kind of a new version of, you know, these old sleeper cars that people could order from the factory.
Oh, right.
It's the Copo Camaro.
Mm-hmm.
And the Copo Camaro is something that Chevy is offering right now. That stands for something. There's a like customer order. I'll come up with it in a second here. But Central Office Production Order is what it is that stands for, Copo. And it's basically a drag racing car that you can order through the factory. And I went to see one of these at a dealership recently.
Yeah.
And took some photos of it. And it was really, really cool. But in addition to the Copo Camaro that he mentions, there's several of these things that he's got here. Now, Kit Cars is one that we've mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Car manufacturers that didn't make it but still built amazing cars. So, like, maybe some that were briefly in production.
Okay.
Very brief production.
Yeah, yeah.
Offline production manufacturers, and he's got several listed here, like SLP for the SS Camaro and Firehawk for GM. AMG that builds Mercedes-Benz cars.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, Ruff for Porsche. Anything Shelby touched, which I think we've talked about already, but
right.
And also Roush for Ford. So that's a good list. So thank you, John, for that.
And, hey, what's another little-known car fact?
Oh, yeah, I've got one here that, you know, we're just now mentioning Ford, so how about this one?
Okay.
I was watching a television show not long ago. It was like the ultimate list of something, right? It was like
okay.
The ultimate rally car is the ultimate this. This is a rally car that they mentioned during this program, and I wrote down this real quickly just because I couldn't believe it when I heard it, and then I read up on it later, and it's true. The Ford RS200, which is a rally car made by Ford a while back. I don't know if they're still – I don't think they're still building this, but
mm-hmm.
Ben, this is like on the order of like a – almost like an Escort-sized body, okay?
Okay.
So the Ford Escort.
Yeah.
And – now, the engine for this rally car is tuned to about 1,000 horsepower. So they've got this massive amount of horsepower out of this car, right?
Mm-hmm.
Extreme amount. And the problem with this has been that when you push a car to that limit, you've got it running on that ragged of an edge.
Yeah.
At full power, when you're you know, rally racing, you can only expect about 10 hours of engine life before it needs a complete engine rebuild. So if you're going to buy one of these for a project or, you know, as a toy...
Yeah.
Expect about 10 hours of hard driving out of it before you have to completely rebuild the engine, and that's not a cheap endeavor. I don't have any numbers on the price of, you know, what that is, because it goes up every year
right.
as parts become more and more scarce and, you know, mm-hmm. the labor and everything goes up. But I can imagine that after 10 hours of use of your project car, your toy, rebuilding the engine every 10 hours. That's in the neighborhood of like Formula One cars that have to be rebuilt every two races or
yeah.
you know, whatever that was.
So. I've got some upcoming events.
Okay.
All right. Let's go with July. We want to keep this far enough in advance that people can still make it.
Okay.
The Concours d'Elegance of America is having its 35th annual iteration in Plymouth, Michigan, July 28th. And for listeners who are familiar with this, yes, go if you can make it, of mm-hmm. course. And for listeners who are not familiar with the Concours d'Elegance, we're just going to give you a brief teaser for our episode on the Concorde. And I guess, Scott, that teaser would be, imagine the best car show you could ever see with the best antique cars ever.
The widest selection and the top of the game of their game. I mean, mm-hmm. these are the best of the best cars that are by invite only.
Yes.
So Concours events. Now, this one's in Plymouth, Michigan. I've never heard of one there because I lived in a town that was like, I mean, literally, I think on the border mm-hmm. with Plymouth. It was Northville, Michigan. For maybe 4 or 5 years I lived there. They never had one in Plymouth, so.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're traveling.
Definitely,
I think, so.
Definitely get to that one if you've got an opportunity. If you're anywhere nearby that's, you know, it's even a half a day's drive, Concours show is definitely worth going to. And we've talked about going to, we're here in Atlanta, and we've talked about going to the Amelia Island show,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, that's a decent drive, but man, I would still consider that completely worth it.
Right, because this gives people a chance to see up close and in real life vehicles that honestly you will have no other chance of seeing.
No, I still remember clearly specific mm-hmm. vehicles that I saw at Concours shows at Meadowbrook in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And I really would like to travel and go to see some of these other shows just for the different location. But man, every year it's a different show. So, you know, make time to go do this.
And I've got one more event also in Michigan.
Okay.
I didn't plan it this way. Sorry. These are just both very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There's an antique and collectible festival at Midland, Michigan Fairgrounds, July 20th through 21st. And this is important because it's a huge auto parts swap meet.
Hmm.
So if you are a listener who is in that area looking for hard to find parts, or just wants to go network and see a lot of show. Now, these cars are not going to be Concours cars. Of course. It's your typical swap meet. But you could find some awesome car parts. And what better way to prepare than to check out our episodes on – like Scott, you're cracking up at my shameless plug.
It worked.
Than to check out our episodes on how to find hard-to-find car parts.
Take some of our own advice here right now anyways. I'm having some trouble with my project car.
Yeah, we need an update on it.
Well, I'm just having a little trouble finding some trim parts and things like mm-hmm. that I need. I need a rear bumper, if anybody's listening. but seriously, like it's harder than you might think when you've got a car that's, you know, neighboring on the 45 years old, 50 years old. It's hard to find parts that still in good condition. And around here, it seems like everything is from, you know, like 1996 on is what they carry in the junkyard.
Right.
Believe it or not.
Now, you're driving a Newport, or you're rebuilding a Newport.
I would like to be driving my Newport. It's a 67 Newport. And I'm having some trouble finding some little parts here and there, and I've done all the appropriate searches and everything, but I need to get in contact with, a guy that knows a guy, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, it has to be, word of mouth now at this point, I think, because I'm just not going to find the part readily available. So,
now,
some setbacks.
We have a listener, that I'll read this, Facebook comment from a listener that will call, PH, and here's why.
Okay. It's very mysterious.
Well, here's why. I don't want to tread on any toes here. The letter begins, "Good morning, guys, longtime listener. In fact, I wrote to you once before regarding your podcast on antique license plates. I had a Beater 1983 pickup with antique tags on it. You were nice enough to give me a pseudonym when you discussed it on the podcast, so I don't want to,
yes.
You know, maybe we should just stick with that. Anyway, the truck's gone. It's been replaced by a 1969 International Harvester Scout 800A. It's my project car. It's sucking up more time and money than I'd care to admit, but it got me thinking," says PH, "that International Harvester might be a cool podcast topic. If that's too narrow, then perhaps one on early SUVs in general, like Scouts, Land Rovers, Broncos, etc. There have been several articles out lately saying that these might be the next hot collectibles." Mm-hmm. And this got me thinking, and there's an autoblog link there too. So thank you, PH, for writing to us. And it did get me thinking, there's so many SUV models that came out, you know, concurrently.
Yeah.
And they may well be these huge collections. Can you imagine going to an antique SUV show?
Well, can I tell you something interesting about this?
Yeah.
Because I've got this one right in front of me now, the same note. I was going to read it. I wrote back to PH And just by sheer coincidence, Ben, the day that he wrote this letter to us, the very day, that morning, in traffic, I followed an International Scout Model 80. Now, his is an 800, which is a step up, and a later model. This was an earlier model, the first model, Model 80, and it was really in rough shape, but it was a beautiful-looking car. I mean, it had a really cool shape to it, a neat front end and everything, and the owner was just as happy as could be to drive this thing. You could tell. I mean, it looked like a lot of fun, and if he says, and if PH here says that, you know, this may be the next hot collectible, and people are saying that, I'm kind of excited by this because I like these old, you know, like the Ford Bronco and, you know, the old Land Rovers and Range Rovers and, I'm sorry, Land Rovers rather.
The old Jeeps are cool, man.
Yeah, the old Jeeps, like the military Jeeps. Ooh. And, I've got a letter here in just a minute I want to read about military Jeeps, but, I think that's really cool. I hope he's right about this.
Yes, I do too. Do you want to jump into that letter?
Why not? Bob from Ohio wrote me not long ago. Wrote us, I should say. And he says he's been listening to the show listening to our show in his garage in Ohio while he's doing some cool upgrades to his 1953 Willys CJ3B Jeep.
A Willy?
Yeah, it's a Willy. Yeah. So it's a Willys Jeep, and he's adding a period 3-point hitch, including hydraulics to run it, and a variable speed governor. So that's his recent projects. But he thought that we could do a show on post-war Jeeps, how they were marketed as an alternative to farm tractors for a lot of people. Now, we had talked about Model T being, one of these utilitarian vehicles that people, you know, would hook up sawmills to and all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
Well, they're saying that, you know, these would be an alternative farm tractors for some people after the war is what they marketed them as. So there's an incredible line of accessories that were available for post-war Jeeps that that Bob thinks that we should maybe cover. And I don't think that's a bad idea. Now, he also mentions that he has and I'm gonna give him a plug here.
Okay.
He has a project that has photography from abandoned cars from the Midwest.
And that's really cool.
Which is really cool because, you know, you've got a lot of rust going on up in that type of region. So these abandoned cars, the project is called Broken Down Heroes, and you can search Broken Down Heroes calendar and get a calendar. You can buy it right from Bob from Ohio, who is a Car Stuff listener. So thank you, Bob. I appreciate it. And I hope you get some sales out of it. And I looked at the site. I looked at some of these photos, and you can order them as prints or whatever. And, some of these would be really cool to have as prints hanging on, you know, either on our cubicle walls or on, maybe even at home.
Mm-hmm. And I've got something here that I wanted to point out as well.
What's
little
that?
Commemorative thing. Mm-hmm. Scott, it has been 60 years since Chevy unveiled the Corvette.
Wow.
And so it's still the longest running production model in GM history. So I just wanted to point, like, I'm not going anywhere
years.
With
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's a long time. And of course, the pace car for this year is Indy 500.
Mm-hmm.
The new Stingray that they just released, which is a really cool design. And you mentioned that it had some crazy new V8 motor that is not available to the public as of yet.
Yeah, but it will be coming back. That is a V8 made in Tonawanda, New York, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And it is, it's interesting because in our pace car episodes, we do mention more so in our most recent one that this is an opportunity for a lot of manufacturers to showcase their new products to the public.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not at all abnormal for a pace car to have some of the newfangled engines
not quite available to the public yet, but it will be later in the year, like maybe in the fall or something.
Right, exactly. Right? It should be the same year. And this also, I wanted to point out that in response to Bob's comment, just the name Willie brought me back. Hemmings Classic Car it's a print magazine that I read. That I have the copy of it now stretched out in front of me. There is a great article on Willie's post-war passenger car efforts. So
that's a perfect fit.
Willie's styling. Now, as you know, during World War II, a lot of car companies had some difficult times. They had stops in production.
Yeah.
A lot of companies did not survive the interwar years between World War I and World War II. And then, when that market came back, it was difficult to figure out to some degree what the American public wanted to buy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where a lot of other companies, also hit the chopping block, unfortunately. But there's this great article with some great drawings, some original clay models of Willie's designs.
Very nice.
That didn't quite make it. So if you guys get a chance to check it out, please do. I'm going to see if I can find a link to this online. And if I do, I'm going to post it.
Yeah, at the Hemmings blog or something like that. There's always a link to their feature story. So
I think we should do a podcast on Willie's.
That's a very good idea. All right. I want to do a couple here just rapid fire because I get a lot of these from Facebook. I get a lot of them from email and all over the place. And rather than reading through a lot of these emails, now I've got a few more that I want to cover later, but
okay.
How about just some rapid fire,
like topic suggestions?
Yeah, just quick ones. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Curtis Rice wrote in and said that, he wanted to see something about the Allegheny Steel Car, which is I had never heard of it, but it's really, really cool design, and you won't believe it when you see it. A Facebook suggestion from Brad Bray, who wanted to hear about cafe racers.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. There's the Carmen Ghia suggestion from Isaac Salgado.
Oh, that's awesome. Isaac, my family had a Carmen Ghia a long time ago.
Really?
I was too young to drive it.
I've always enjoyed that design. That's a really cool one. So then there's Tesla Motors, which we talked about earlier, and that was from Christopher Manns, who wrote in via email. Let's see. There's police cars from someone named Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Then we've got there's the 1953 Le Mans Jaguar team story, which is, I don't know, this is kind of just more like urban legend myth type thing that we need to clear up. And that was from, that's from Fast Sandy.
Oh, hey, Fast Sandy.
Yeah.
Good to hear from you.
We're a fan of him. Remember?
Yes,
so,
I know.
Okay. So, there's also Iron Curtain Cars. That was a suggestion from Harold Eck.
Oh, I love a good foreign car, man.
Iron Curtain Cars. So we're talking about like the Yugo and the Skoda and the Tatra, Trabant. A lot of different cars there. So Street Legal Bumper Cars, and that was a suggestion from Joshua Baker. 10 most influential people in the motoring world. That's from Richard Morgan.
Oh, that's tough to make that list.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Let's see. Pontiac's overhead cam, 6-cylinder engine, that goes way back to the 60s. That's John DeLorean's idea, as a matter of fact, way ahead of its time. That was from Joseph, Farias, I think. I don't know how to say the last name, but Joseph, thank you. Early electric cars. Listener suggestion from Kevin Loving from Facebook.
Early electric cars. That's a really good point there, Kevin.
This is going back to like Baker Electric Car and the Detroit Electric Car Company.
Exactly. This is something that we've talked about before, Scott. So many people don't know how far back electric car technology goes. Now, I mean, clearly, I'm more inclined to be a fan of it once we get the pieces working correctly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what a lot of people don't consider is that for some time in the very beginning of the automotive industry, there were quite a few people who pinned their hopes on electric vehicles.
Absolutely. It was steam, then it was electric, and then it was internal combustion.
Yep.
And they kind of duked it out there for a while, and then eventually, you know, internal combustion won over. But steam, electric, internal combustion, and we've talked about that at pretty good length in the past, but to focus on a couple of early electric cars, that's a great idea. So, thanks again, Kevin. I appreciate that one. And I'll just again quickly.
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
Oh, that's all right. Quickly, V8 supercar series.
Cool.
Dallas Lee from Australia wants to hear about that, and just more Australian market cars in general. He would like to hear about, of course. I think there's something there with the sport Ute vehicles because they're really popular over there, and they're not as popular here.
Mm-hmm.
Suzuki cars. The good and the bad, I guess, maybe, from Mauricia Garcia. Driving controversy on, you know what, that's my own thing, never mind. I didn't mean to read that out loud, but there's controversial moves that drivers have made during races. Now, we talked about, this is my own, it's not a listener suggestion.
That's fine, I'm still writing it down.
We talked about last laps, you know, that were great, and you know, we had some audio, you know, clips in with that, and that was really cool. It was a fun one to do.
And we had some controversial moves in there, like the passes on the turn.
Yeah, some of that stuff. Yeah. So moves were within that, but this is more like controversial moves within the race that don't have to be in the last lap, that could be in, you know, anywhere within the race.
Okay.
Whether they were foolhardy or whether they were heroic, I guess.
Oh,
maybe
okay.
Is the way to put it. So I've got a few examples here that, you know, I'm not going to read right now, but that's something I'm kind of working on the back burner.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. The MG company history by George Campbell wanted to hear that, and he's from Sydney, Australia as well. Listener from Sydney.
Okay.
So thank you, George, for that. Delahaye history. Tim Cleary wanted to hear about Delahaye history. And let's see, we've done a lot of these, Ben, but
yeah.
MotoGP from Paul Redcoat Clark.
That's
so
awesome.
So thank you, Paul. So the MotoGP series is something we'll talk about in the future, I promise.
I've got something here for you.
Man, that's a lot of time.
Yeah. Sorry. We've got a lot of stuff.
Just before, real quick.
Yeah.
Maybe listeners will get an idea like why sometimes when they suggest something, it takes a little while to get it into the rotation. And, you know, cause this is just part of the list that we get all the time.
Yeah.
So, great suggestions and we try to get through them as quickly as we can. So we're working on all of these.
We have a lot of fun with this stuff too. I wanted to point out something, back to Bob's, statement about Willys and the, Jeeps here, the post-war Jeeps. There's a great little mention here, 1950 to 51, the Willys Jeepster. It was called one of the trendiest vehicles to come along in years. It has a two-wheel drive convertible version of the larger, more comfortable Jeep station wagon.
Hmm.
And it has some features that are striking, like the cut-down doors are kind of reminiscent of European sports car fashion of the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a 72-horsepower four-cylinder or a 75-horsepower straight six. And this was a car that was very versatile. But I'm going to show this to you because once you get a picture of this, this looks pretty long.
Is it this one right here,
yeah,
right? The Jeepster?
Right here.
Now, I had a friend in high school that had a Jeepster that was not this year, not this make and model, but it was it wasn't this make and model. It was a Willys Jeepster. It was a Jeepster. And he and his father worked on it as a restoration project, and it was the coolest car in our high school parking lot, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
It was really, really neat. I mean, it was well done, and they did a great job with it. You know, he did the right thing every winter and oiled the whole bottom of the car, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, it never got any rust on it at all. It was a gorgeous car up until the point when we graduated. I don't know what happened after that. But you know what? That looks like a fun car to drive, and you know who else likes to drive, Ben? Number three here on my list, because I've already gone through two. We did
mm-hmm.
the 1,000-piece crankshaft. We did the Ford RS200, which requires a new engine every 10 hours.
Yes.
That's ridiculous.
And that's hours, not miles.
Hours, yeah. Number three here on my list is the 1930 blower Bentley. Now, this is funny because this ties back into, remember was the Fast Lady? Is that the one that we keep? It keeps coming up, Ben. It keeps coming up in our conversations, right?
Uh-huh.
That kind of funny movie, British comedy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Get this. Now, the top speed of these cars was 137 miles per hour of these 1930 Blower Bentleys. So obviously, it's a supercharged car. There was also a non-supercharged version. But the supercharged versions were, according to AutoWeek in a 2007 article, the supercharged versions were fragile and thirsty cars. And it's something you wouldn't really think about. Now, boy, this is where it gets a little bit confusing. Fragile and thirsty, yes, that's right. And the non-supercharged versions, they got about 15 miles per gallon from a 4.5-liter engine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these are big, you know, huge cars, very squared off. There's not really anything aerodynamic about them at all. They're just very powerful cars. The supercharged version, the one that I'm talking about here, these blower Bentleys, again, 4.5-liter, same engine, but it's supercharged. 3 miles per gallon, Ben, is what they achieved on the track.
Wow.
So at speed, you know, on race form or whatever, 3 miles per gallon is what they did. So they were not so great for racing long distances, in races like Le Mans, which, you know, astute listeners maybe say, wait a minute, I know a little something about Bentley history. And, Bentley cars actually won Le Mans in 1924,
yep.
26, 27, 28, and 29. However, those were not the blower Bentley versions. Those were the standard Bentley versions. Now, the blower Bentleys, they just weren't made for that type of race and that type of environment.
Yeah, I don't know if achieved is the right word to use with three miles per gallon,
and that was in 1930. Now, you know, 15 miles per gallon isn't great either, but that sure tops 3 miles per gallon.
Jeepers.
And there was some recent news about, you know, the these cars are still owned by Bentley, the motor company.
Yeah.
And the two of these cars are being brought out for this year's Mille Miglia race, which is the 1,000-mile race that happens in Italy. And it's kind of like a commemorative race, really, at this point. It's not the true race that happened in the, like, 1920 through 1957, 1927 through 57, I think it was. And by the way, that race, they said, brought out as many as 5 million people to the roadside to watch those cars. 5 million because it's a 1,000-mile race that went from Brescia to Rome and then from Rome back to Brescia. And 5 million people would line the roads during that race from 1927 to 1957.
You know what I just realized? We're going to have to come back and do another Nuts and Bolts.
I think we're going to have to.
There's no way we can get through all this stuff. I just want to do I only have two more things. I want one of them to be last because I think it's really cool.
Okay. And then tell you what, I'll hit you with this number four thing.
Okay.
We've done an awful lot of listener mail, but we are going to have to come back and do more. We get so much great listener mail. Keep it up, guys. It's really, really good.
And a lot of the stories are really, really good points and also hilarious.
Yeah,
that prom story still.
We get some good stories, and we get some good photos, too. You know, a lot of people send in photos of their projects or of, them, you know, again, driving the 1936 Rolls to prom. I mean, we've got a photo of that car. We've got all kinds of really good, you know, good stuff that comes from our listeners, and we want that to keep pouring in. We really enjoy the suggestions. We really enjoy the stories, the anecdotes, you know, telling us when we're right, when we're wrong about something. We appreciate it all.
We're not above being wrong. We admit our mistakes.
I often am.
So just a little piece of trivia to sandwich between our little known car facts here. Sidebar, Scott. Factoid is something that is commonly believed to be true, but is not actually true.
Hmm.
So whenever you hear somebody say factoid, they might be saying, they might mean fact.
So I'm lying to you. That's what they're saying.
Well, yeah, it's like something that kind of like an old wives' tale.
How about
almost.
I'm lying to you, but I don't mean to.
Right. Yeah. It's not purposely lying. It's just, it's misinformation, not disinformation.
Understood.
This, however, is a fact and not a factoid. An F1 car experiences so much downforce that it could theoretically drive upside down at only 105 miles an hour or 170 kilometers.
Okay. Is that a fact or is that a factoid? Because that's never actually been done.
You are correct, sir. And I'm so glad you pointed out. This is theoretically, this is based on calculations of the design and the power of an F1. And we know that they generate tremendous downforce, but is it enough downforce to do this? And if so, why hasn't anyone tried it?
All right. I've seen some clever commercials that have shown cars that have gone, like, you know, up and around and over cars and tunnels and things like that, right? Now, we haven't actually seen anybody do this and test this and actually make it work. I kind of think, I really do think that somebody's probably working on this as a stunt that may happen in, let's say 10 years from now. That somebody may put this into practice and literally do this as a stunt, as a trick to show that it can be done with an F1 car.
Like a proof of concept.
Yeah, exactly. That, you know, they say it can be done. The numbers say it can be done. I'm going to try this and we're going to lay this out, you know, mathematically, statistically, make it work so that it's relatively safe for the driver and everybody involved. And we're going to film it and we're going to show it and it's going to blow everybody's mind.
Well, I think a full loop wouldn't work, but maybe one corkscrew. Would be a way to pull
I was
off.
Think. See, what I was thinking is you roll up to you're directly upside down, drive for a certain distance, whether it's a quarter mile or whatever it is, and then roll it back down the other way.
Okay, that makes
so,
sense.
So you're sustaining that upside down momentum, I guess, or that motion instead of just doing a like one time around, because it seems like that could almost be done. You know, you could see skateboarders do stuff like that. You can see motorcycles do stuff like that. But to maintain that's the trick, is to maintain the downforce completely upside down to the track and adhere to the roof. That's what the trick is.
It's also a very risky, a financially risky endeavor.
Oh, sure. And good luck finding the driver that wants to try this the first time.
Let's keep in mind that F1 cars are not, you know, at all affordable.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Good point.
Okay, so what's number
four? So my number four, and probably the last thing that I'll mention in this entire podcast, because we've got to, like you said, we got to break it up into another one.
Yeah.
I read something recently about our good friend Henry Ford again. And this is all about Model T engine production. And
okay.
this kind of brought to mind that, man, I really think now looking back at this that Henry, if no one had really stepped in and said, you know, we gotta update this to the Model A. We gotta start moving on, we gotta grow as a company, I really think that Henry Ford would have run that Model T as a production car right up until the 1950s or whenever when he retired. I can't remember the exact date when he retired, but I feel like he would have just maintained, you know, the course as he was going and would not have changed anything about the Model T because he had a formula that worked, right?
Right.
All right. So the Model T engine production run, Ben, this is unbelievable. It ran from September 27th, 1908, which is not a big surprise, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Model T itself ended production in 1927. However, they continued production on the engine until August 4th, 1941.
41?
1941. And that equals out to exactly 12,000 calendar days. So it's 32 years, 10 months, 9 days. That's how long the production run was. Exactly 12,000 days. Now that sounds planned to me, that they knew
it
that it
sure
was
does.
Do that. Now the specs for that, the engine specs for that entire run, that 33 year run, remained almost completely unchanged for the entirety of that production run. Again, so the U.S., I don't know, about 19 years was the run of the Model T, maybe a little bit shorter from 1908 to 27. But the engine again, I mean, there was an industrial and military market and marine market, I guess, that mm-hmm. fueled the need for this. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just Ford being crazy Ford. It was Ford, you know, actually filling a need. Until 1941, but I had no idea that it went all the way until the early 1940s. And again, this odd production thing, this 12,000 days thing, that is so bizarre to me. I don't know why that stood out as a sore thumb, but it's a strange figure.
Well, maybe they decided on that partway through, you know?
Maybe
they were on 11,000 something.
I think so. I think we're going to end production here, but let's just tell you what. You know what would be neat is if we stretched it out to exactly 12,000 mm-hmm. days, and then we can use that in our marketing or whatever. But I don't really recall reading that anywhere else mm-hmm. that it was produced until. I mean, so again, the Model T, 1908 to 1927, the Model T engine, 1908 to 1941. That's odd.
That is very odd. Now, I've got something here that I think is intriguing. I wanted to save this for the end of our podcast. I apologize because I believe listeners sent this to us and I didn't grab the name. I will bring this up in our next episode. Guess who is sponsoring a new land speed attempt?
A new land speed attempt. Mm-hmm. Would it be – is it Bugatti?
It is Rolls-Royce.
No.
Yep, Rolls-Royce is sponsoring a 1,000-mile-per-hour Bloodhound SSC project.
No kidding.
Yep. They're going to support the project, and they see it as an educational program and, of course, a real-life land speed record attempt to break the barrier there, the 1,000-mph barrier.
So we've talked about the Bloodhound in the past, I know, because
yes.
we talked about the Thrust SSC,
mm-hmm.
and that was such a cool thing to watch. But,
yep.
Man, so Rolls-Royce is throwing their name behind the Bloodhound.
Yeah, they're going to give them an EJ200 engine. That's from a Eurofighter Typhoon. And then it's also going to have a Cosworth F1 engine driving the rocket oxidizer pump. Together, this generates, wait for it, Scott, 135,000 equivalent horsepower.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's 180 times an F1 car.
135,000 horsepower.
Yes.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's equivalent.
This sounds so cool. I'm gonna love watching this thing, even in test runs. You know, it's mm-hmm. going to be really cool to watch.
And so they're hoping to break... You know, it's weird. They're trying to break two barriers. They want to break the 763 mph set by the Thrust mm-hmm. in 97, and they want to break the 1,000 mph. That has just never happened.
They're going to top 1,000 miles per hour on the ground.
They hope they will. I don't know. That's
boy. I feel like we need to investigate what these wheels are going to be made out of. Because remember, there were some crazy materials that, that made the wheels of the other vehicles. And there's a lot of really strange rules that go into this. Like, they have to make sure that the wheels stay on the ground. They walk the entire track.
Yes.
Because if it's actually a low-flying airplane, it doesn't make the...
It's not land speed.
It has to be connected to the ground through the wheels. So there's always there's got to be a tire track that goes the entire length of the run. Man, there's so many cool rules about this thing too, and it's just it'd be neat to be able to go see that run being made.
Well, all we have to do is travel to, I believe it's Coxkin Pond. I may not be pronouncing that correctly, in South Africa. The car's going to be in the desert. They're going to check it out there. It's going to be 2 miles wide, 12 miles long, and perfectly flat.
Unbelievable.
Which is still key, you know, just like the salt flats, you got to be perfectly flat.
Yeah.
Wide open spaces.
And
just
in good condition, like, you know, no rain prior to that and everything. So this is a weather-dependent record as well. Man, no side gusts of wind and all that. I mean, weather plays a big, big role.
And our listeners have played a big, big role in this and every show. So I want to thank everybody who wrote in. Scott, I'm going to read their names off super quickly.
Yeah. If you didn't hear your name, listen for the next Nuts and Bolts episode.
Yes.
From this episode, however.
From this episode, however. Thank you, Scott. We had Gary, Adrian, Luke, Rudy, Richard, Eric, Bruce, Glenn, Simon, John, PH, Bob, Curtis, Brad, Isaac, Christopher, Mike, Joshua, Richard, Joseph, Kevin, Dallas, Mauricia, George, Tim, Paul, and, of course, Vast Sandy. Thank you guys so much for writing in. I believe I got everybody's name. I may have missed it. If I did, just drop us a line on Facebook, drop us a line on Twitter. Let me know so I can thank you in our upcoming episode. Or if you want to write us a letter and see if you get on the air, send us an email. We are
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.